responsive to Dilthey's plea for a social psychology to substantiate historical analysis, the Frankfurtians showed early sensitivity to the possibilities of psychoanalysis. However, not until 1932, when Fromm entered the institute, was psychoanalysis systematically incorporated into the historical materialism of the group. In a series of programmatic statements, the first of which is reproduced here, Fromm attempted a systematic merger of Marx and Freud at roughly the same time as Reich. The parameters of the attempt are too well known to require elaboration here. Fromm's early argument was as simply as it was obvious. As Freud had diagnosed pathologies as products of the individual's history, it was a short step to show that the individual's history, for example, within the family, was itself embedded in a contingent on a larger collectivity. As an agent of socialization, the family produced the character types and behaviors typical of and functional for the particular socio-economic class. Fromm explained specific kinds of drives as active and passive adaptations of specific socio-economic situation. The primary formative factor, without denying their biological base, Fromm could thus show the behavioral expressions of drives and subsequently their different forms of gratification to be dynamic responses and necessary forms of historical behavior. Given the psychostructure produced by different socio-economic conditions, class-specific needs, conflicts, pressures, and possibilities can hardly be considered anthropological constant. Page 388. Through these psychostructures, social conditions are reproduced within the individuals not only in the form of explicit values and material necessities, which then tend toward congenial social forms, but of drives. As long as they remain unconscious and are perceived as natural, these social sediments are alien forces within humans, a form of heteronomy. Adorno would have added, changing human motivation and drives presupposes that they are recognized as products of situation, as Freud had suggested. The early Freud had suspected, but then disregarded the influence of the larger social framework. Most of the categories and topics of Fromm's Marx's Freud synthesis re-emerged in the various political, cultural, and aesthetic analysis of the group in the following decades. Most important to them, however, and surprising only at first glance, was the obstinate retention of the biological base and the emphasis of the historical forms of drives. Thus, they challenged the universality of the Oedipal phase just as much as the specific biological interpretation of the death drive, like Reich. They saw the latter as the biologization of destructive tendency in society, which deflected attention from the real social pathogenesis. In an analogous argument, Adorno derided Heidegger for enshrining as an existential angst the realistic fear which social conditions instilled in individuals. The basic pattern of the social interpretation of supposed existential human drives and needs was to remain valid for most of the institute, except, ironically, from himself, with growing disagreements. Fromm moved out of the institute, and the other members in often bitter attacks chided him for surrendering the progressive thrust of his earlier approach. Not only did Fromm assume a human nature again, but he even surrendered what was perhaps the most critical of Freud's conceptions, the libidinal base. Visit Adorno, Horkheimer, and Marcuse complained, disappeared in theoretical base for the only true irreconcilable and incompatible dimension in humans, the deviation in principle, the always overshooting expectation, the non-identity with any status quo, the true critical concept in Freud. In another stroke of irony, the later Marcuse, who had shown little interest in the Marx-Freud synthesis during the 30s, attempted the merger once more in the frame of a general theory of culture. For the most part, the Frankfurtians employed Freudian concepts to explain salient contemporary forms of consciousness and behavior, for example, the authoritarian personality. Page 389. Marcuse, however, sought to redeem the critical potential of psychoanalysis by turning it into a positive theory of emancipation. When he published Eros and Civilization in 1955, his former colleagues did not comment, except Fromm, who disapproved. In all likelihood, Marcuse's caution attempt to spell out specific of the future liberated personality in society in the positive rather than the just critical use of the biological base may have struck them as an undue limitation of future possibilities. Yet, besides the critical potential of any positive alternative, this alternative seemed viable. A concrete possibility given the material and technological conditions of the present. In the aestheticized society, critique in its instruments would be aufgehoben, eliminated as critique by being realized in reality. Almost two decades later, in Counter-Revolution and Revolt, Marcuse resumed the critical focus. Non-conceivable historical reality could attain the unity, identity, of subject and object. The subject, as a force of production, ahead of the objective conditions, could be suspended only in a dead-end utopia. Like the libidinal base, the aesthetic mode was critical in principle. As critical theorists practiced it, both sociology of knowledge and psychoanalytical social psychology were to be critical, self-reflexive, and emancipatory tools without loss of their scientificity, systematizing the social mediations of consciousness and motivation. They were to preserve the historical truth as well as to expose the historical contingency of these forms. In this sense, critical theory might be called a kind of socio-epistemology. Its underlying practical thrust is unmistakable as the basic patterns with foreshadows Habermas's later claim for psychoanalysis as a science rooted in an emancipatory cognitive interest. Fromm had argued that in contrast with survival needs, sexual drives can be satisfied without real means, that is, even through fantasies, sometimes that place the ruling class in the position of being able to offer its choices of gratification to the dominated classes. The primary cognitive interest, a recurrent term in Horkheimer's work, then was to keep the forms these choices took from appearing natural or given, to redeem them and their specific forms of consciousness. The critique of what is excluded from these forms is not superfluous to stringent analysis, but is an inherent requirement of objectivity. If scientific interest is directed toward the whole truth, which, as we saw, always transcends, exceeds the given, the accurate, full, and objective description of the truth is critique by definition because it exceeds the status quo.